I'm speaking with Dr. Lori, that's L-O-R-I, Minassian, M-I-N-A-S-I-A-N, on December 9th, 2008. And I have permission to record the call.
Yes.
Thank you. I would like to start out some background a bit. Struck me as a bit unusual, perhaps, for a math major to wind up in oncology.
Yes, that is true. I enjoyed math, but I was also very much interested in working with and for people. And math can be a very a job that's very sort of isolated. I mean, you can the options for working with people end up being more applied math, either, you know, as a professor or as an in an engineering field or something along those lines. And when I was getting my math major, most of my friends in the math world were joining companies that contracted with the Defense Department, and mm-hmm. I was less interested in that, and I was always interested in medicine, and so where it crosses, where my math background has served me the best, is in the clinical trials perspective.
Mm-hmm. In other words, in terms of statistics, in terms of
Well, I think somewhat in terms of statistics, but more really fundamental in terms of logic,
mm-hmm.
and sort of the rationale in the design of studies and things of that sort.
I mean, I was going to say natural order, but it's giving it an order.
Yes, trying to bring order out of chaos. Yes.
Is that theoretical math or applied math?
That's applied math. Bringing chaos out, bringing order to chaos is applied math, very clearly.
Chaos out of order is something else.
Right, and requires a lot of psychosocial support, which oncology requires too.
After you graduated from UCLA, you went on to a medical degree?
Yes.
And but you then went in internal medicine. Can you?
Oh, you have to. If you're going
okay.
to go into, if the training in the broad world of medicine is that you choose sort of your area being pediatrics, surgery, internal medicine, GYN. You choose the broad area. And then from that, if you have an interest in cancer, then there is, you know, further training amongst that area in oncology. So if you're interested in peds oncology, you do your pediatric training first, and then you do pediatric oncology training.
Mm-hmm.
I like general internal medicine, and then oncology as a subspecialty from that.
And is that what attracted you to GW, or?
Oh, no. I mean, what attracted me to GW was the fact that at that time there were lots of people applying to medical school. There weren't that many spots, and most of the California places were pretty locked up. So, you know, there was a good 20 to 30% of GW's class were California state residents.
Hmm. And the reason you picked GW was?
It picked me.
Oh, because it picked you. Well, that's often the case with graduate school.
Yep.
tell me the progression from there into oncology, because initially you were into treatment, as I reading your CV.
Oh, well, I mean, I did my did medical school. I was interested in at the time that I finished my medical school, I wasn't sure that I was going to go into oncology. I mean, I had an interest in it, but I wasn't really sure that that's where I was going to end up. And then I did internal medicine because I liked the sort of the whole perspective, the logic that went into thinking about and taking care of patients, as well as the psychosocial piece to it. And then when I was in my internal medicine training, it became clear that my interest in cancer grew, and that was the area that I wanted to make my specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, then I applied to a variety of oncology fellowship training programs. I got into Sloan Kettering. I was very interested in the program they had there. And then my then-boyfriend, soon-to-be husband, was already at Yale. And so it made perfect sense. And my training at Sloan Kettering was phenomenal. I couldn't have had, I mean, that was something where I couldn't have got that sort of training elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it was training that spanned the care of patients, research and oncology research, some in drug development, some in clinical trials, but also a lot sort of in clinical trials methodology, which was really not something people were getting elsewhere.
And the math background, I take it, helped in that as well.
Oh yeah.
And in looking at, because I know some of the earlier papers you did were on interleukin 2 and interferon, which
a lot of things happen because you happen to be in the right place at the right time. Let me ask you a question though. Before, are we doing this on me or are we doing this on the division?
Both.
Oh, okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Fair enough.
The answer is yes.
Okay. Go on.
Cancer early cancer treatment drugs, I guess. I'm curious what took you away from that and then into cancer prevention rather than treatment.
Oh, a lot of things are very serendipitous, and this was classic. I did my fellowship training in two different areas. I did it in melanoma and worked with somebody who spent his whole life in kidney cancer. And immunotherapy and interleukin were, you know, those were the sort of the hallmark methods for treating both melanoma and kidney cancer at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I went down to the Medical College of Georgia. So I had done some work at Memorial in melanoma and kidney cancer, and then I find myself at the Medical College of Georgia with very limited resources. I went from someplace that had huge amounts of support for their young investigators, for their clinical investigators, to a place that had expectations that the clinicians were basically there as a service function, and research happened if you got your funding. If you got NIH grants, that was wonderful, but, you know, your function as a physician was clinical service. And so I, you know, there were some clinical research activities there, and I did work with a couple of different investigators down there, but the truth of the matter is the opportunities were relatively limited.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what sort of took me away from what I was doing in terms of Sloan Kettering, which was fine. And then, for a variety of reasons, I came up to NIH and, again, you know, sort of found myself in the Division of Cancer Prevention. And that's sort of how it all happened.
The Community Oncology and Rehabilitation Branch.
That was the old name, yeah.
Was the old name for DCP.
It was the old name for the branch that housed my program in DCP. The old name for DCP was the Division of Cancer Prevention and Control.
Correct. DCP. Yes.
And then in DCPC, the branch that the CCOP program was in was the Community Oncology and Rehabilitation Branch.
Okay.
But when they restructured the division and turned it into the Division of Cancer Prevention and the Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences, that's when all of the branches were redone, and the branch that I was in became the Community Oncology and Prevention Trials Research Group, really. And that's, you know, but essentially what we did stayed the same.
But where did the rehabilitation part come in?
The rehabilitation part was really the research focus. We called it rehabilitation, but really what it was the pieces of supportive care that accompany some of the work that was done in the CCOP program. So all of the treatment trials were run out of the Division of Cancer Prevention, the Division of Cancer Treatment and Diagnosis, or whatever it was called through its various and sundry iterations. CTEP ran the treatment trials. CCOP program ran the prevention trials, hence the Division of Cancer Prevention. But it also had a focus for supportive care, end-of-life, symptom management, which was what the rehabilitation part was supposed to encompass, you know, quality of life, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Rehabilitation was never the best descriptor, okay, because it wasn't really rehab. Rehab suggests that you are less functional and you're going to actively do something to regain your function.
Correct. I think of that in terms of polio, for example.
Right. And while there is functional loss in cancer patients during chemotherapy, there is research to try and regain function, it is not really the same as, say, cardiac rehab or stroke rehab or something of that sort. It really isn't to the level, because that both cardiac and stroke rehab has this connotation of building back strength. And there's never been a oncology rehab program that is the same type of thing. So rehab was not ever really the best descriptor. A better descriptor, and you couldn't, and the reason why I think rehab was used, because it was a single term that encompassed many different pieces, but it was a suboptimal term, because the pieces were quality of life, end of care, supportive care, those things to do during chemotherapy or during treatment, more than just chemotherapy, could be radiation or surgery. So those pieces that were done either before or after or during treatment in an attempt to either prevent loss of function or regain function once it's been lost, but it was never of the same it was never as fully encompassed as either cardiac or stroke rehab. It's not like you can send your cancer patient to a rehab facility to regain their strength before they go back to work or whatever it is, their lives. It's not the same thing.
How did you get recruited to come up here? Let me put it that way.
Oh, I knew somebody who knew that there was a job opening. So it's like, well, you should come up and interview for this job. It's like, well, what does the job entail? Well, you should come up and interview this for this job. That's how it all happened.
And who did you interview with?
Leslie. I interviewed with Leslie Ford. I didn't know her at the time, but I interviewed with her.
And what were they looking for?
They were looking for a medical oncologist that knew clinical trials and knew something about the care of patients, and you know, knew the cancer patients, basically. You know, they wanted somebody who had some practical hands-on experience as well as understood, you know, clinical trials, who could really speak to the investigators in the program.
And this was a intramural or extramural program?
Extramural program.
That you were running, extramural.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you how did the division set the agenda for that program?
Clarify that.
Well, did they come to you with what they want to do, or did you set an agenda for the kind of clinical trials that you thought
Oh, it was a combination. The larger trials, there was much... Well, when I came to the program, both the breast cancer and the prostate cancer prevention trials were up and running.
Mm-hmm.
So that agenda was already set, and there was some work in developing what are the other, you know, what other kinds of trials do we want to engage in? Do we want to have a colon cancer? What other? So there was already a division-level set agenda with respect to sort of the high-profile prevention trials. Okay. Then with respect to some of the trials that would be under the rubric of the rehab or the supportive care or the quality of life or the symptom management, that was pretty much left, that was considered of not the same priority level, and so I was able to set the agenda in that area. And it took, I would say, a considerable amount of time to get a feel for what the level of interest was in the investigator community, as well as, you know, the capacity and the feasibility of the network.
Were there a number of people, well, let me put it this way, a critical mass of people working in cancer prevention?
There's always been a much, I mean, there's always been, or I should say, there are huge numbers of people or a significant community. There's a significant community now that has grown over the past 30 years in size and scope in the cancer treatment in the therapeutic world. There is a much smaller community in cancer prevention. I think some of it stems from the fact that it takes so long for prevention trials to run. Some of it stems from the fact that you really need a good, good handle on the biology of carcinogenesis. And we're really just now getting to the point with the targeted agents of maybe having a significant hypothesis for how to, which agents to choose, how to sequence them, how to think about using them for prevention. it's really, that wasn't there before, and now there's this, now what's happening, I think, is you have people that are really sort of coming from the therapeutic world that are, you know, trying to understand the earliest steps in carcinogenesis, that are thinking about how early can we start this, and so there's this tension about what's earliest treatment versus what's true prevention. And the FDA doesn't even call it prevention. The FDA says risk reduction. You know, the indications that we have for tamoxifen, raloxifene, and Celebrex are all risk reduction indications. They're not prevention indications.
Mm-hmm. And how has the in the long view of prevention versus treatment at NIH, you know, there's that, you know, the
tension.
The tension between that and the tradition of being disease treatment oriented rather than preventive oriented, I guess, and prevention oriented in NCI. How has that had an impact on the division?
Well, let's. I'm going to take that question from a different perspective, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's all kinds of politics that have gone on between the NCI and the division level that I'm not going to go into. However, I think we can look to something that's been happening in cardiology for a while. Certainly, oncologists look to cardiology because they've used biomarkers for in their disease trials and things like that. But more importantly and more fundamental about this tension between treatment and prevention is a little bit also in just what is happening in terms of out there in practice in terms of prevention and treatment for cardiovascular disease. Certainly, the cardiologists are at the forefront and remain at the forefront of treating active cardiac disease or cardiovascular disease. Nothing's changed that. That being said, there's been a huge amount of work in cardiovascular disease prevention in terms of controlling hypertension, controlling lipid levels, lifestyle interventions. And so you have internists who are extremely well trained in both the prevention and treatment of cardiovascular disease. And they do it at one level. And when things become either very complicated or even somewhat complicated, the referrals to cardiologists are relatively quick and relatively, I can't say seamless because nothing's seamless in the current system. But, I mean, there seems to be less tension between prevention and treatment and more of a sense of a spectrum. And the cardiologists get involved in the design of the early cardiovascular disease prevention trials, but they're also actively involved in treatment trials. And so there seems to be enough of a sense that, you know, the internists need to be on the first line of cardiovascular disease prevention and possibly even the very first lines of treatment. But there is this interplay between referrals and discussions of what is involved in prevention of cardiovascular disease and what is involved in treatment. And there doesn't, and maybe because I'm on the outside looking in, it doesn't appear as if there is that much tension. And so, I mean, I think oncology can get to that point. I think right now people are thinking, and one of the single biggest boundaries to hurdle in terms of, you know, that paradigm, and one of the biggest differences, once a patient is diagnosed with cancer, immediately everybody suddenly takes a step back. Your internist, your non-oncologist takes a step back and says, it's now for the time for the cancer specialist.
Mm-hmm.
Boom. That's it. And that's it, you know, as opposed to, you know, the oncologist will take care of the cancer and we'll take care of everything else, or maybe we'll do some supportive care involved in it. No, it's like now the oncologist becomes a primary care physician for the cancer patient. So that's a little bit of the difference.
In cancer prevention, it seems that there are a couple of levels here. One is a public health issue.
Yeah.
And the other is more specific clinical towards specific cancers. Do I read that correctly, or?
Well, I think so. And part of this is this tension, if you will, between this whole concept that you should be, you know, this whole wellness concept versus the idea that, you know, that not all cancer is the same. And the carcinogenesis process for breast cancer may be substantially different from colon cancer, may be different from head and neck cancer. I mean, carcinogenesis is not one process that applies absolutely the same to all different cell lines in the body. It appears to be quite different. Cervical cancer, head and neck cancer, more and more, you know, may be virally mediated. Hepatomas may be virally mediated, you know, and then you have other cancers that may not be virally mediated. So you've got, if you're thinking that cancer prevention is going to be the interruption of the cancer process, then you got to know the cancer process and you've got to figure out what's the pivotal place to interrupt so that you halt the process and return back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be that the same. There is one process to prevent cancer in every cell line. It may be that there are a couple of different processes. And just like we vaccinate against multiple different types of infectious agents, we might have to consider a couple of different strategies for reducing the highest prevalence cancers, or we may have to move from a concept of treating everybody, thinking of population cancer prevention, to thinking about targeted cancer prevention.
And where will advances in genomic research fit into that?
Well, advances in genomic research would feed very much into the idea of targeted cancer prevention. So that if you know that you're at risk for these three cancers or this one cancer, perhaps your cancer prevention strategy is different from someone who is baseline risk.
And how, what's the impact of that on clinical community trials?
Well, there's potentially a huge impact depending upon where the prevention trials go. And the last four large prevention trials have basically been recruiting your general population, or in the case of the breast cancer, the higher risk population, but from a general population. There hasn't been a requirement to date of requiring some sort of a screening test before you could be considered eligible for a prevention trial, and we may be moving towards that. But other diseases may be moving towards that as well, and so there is going to be sort of a or there's going to be a need to think about disease somewhat differently as we understand and unfold what the genome is trying to tell us. But, I mean, from my perspective, just understanding what the genome is like finding the alphabet or finding a dictionary, okay? It's even with a dictionary, you don't have the tools to understand the language. You can understand the words, possibly. You can translate the words, but you don't really get the meaning that you do from a sentence based upon the context, the idioms, the culture. All of that falls into understanding the language. And we're quite a ways from understanding the language of how to translate the genome into practical medicine.
No Rosetta Stone yet.
No Rosetta Stone yet.
Could you describe for me the changes in the community oncology program over the last two decades?
Mm. Oh, there's been considerable change. One of the most apparent change is the complexity and the level of the clinical trials. When the trial started 20 years ago, they were, first of all, they were rather thin. There was, limited amount that was in the clinical trials. It was very specific. There wasn't a whole lot of regulatory issues involved. You had your IRB and you had oversight, but the amount of regulatory barriers or hurdles was much smaller. The consent forms were much simpler, and the design of the trials were much simpler. I mean, 20 years ago, we were looking to see, if any chemotherapy agent reduced recurrence rates. Now we're looking for, and we succeeded. I mean, in breast cancer now, in colon cancer, in so many, even in prostate cancer, we have lengthened the time from diagnosis to death. Okay, so we've had this huge lead time bias in terms of actually improving the number of survivors that are around. Most of the clinical trials that were started in the treatment trials in the 80s, there were not that many. In the 80s, there were very few cancer survivors. And now, 20-plus years from now, 30 years now, we have, a growing number of survivors. So we have had success, but now the trials, to show even more success, have to be larger, somewhat more complicated, and the regulatory oversight is more complicated as well. And the trials are larger because what we're looking for is incremental benefit over the already successful regimen. So we're trying to take a successful regimen and make it more successful by adding additional things to it.
And these different regimens, have they changed as well?
Over time, yeah.
For example?
Well, we can start using the breast cancer analogy. Mm-hmm. We in the early 90s, had treated most women with early-stage breast cancer with Adriamycin and Cytoxan, AC. And then we found that adding Taxol improved the decreased the rate of recurrence and improved survival. And then we found out that Herceptin could, if you were HER2 positive, could improve survival. And so now you have, a much more complicated regimen that involves, three chemotherapy agents, a targeted agent, and possibly also hormonal therapy, depending on whether or not the patient is hormone responsive. So you have, sort of a time when we've gone from a time when very few things worked to we've got effective agents and we're adding them on top. And so potentially the length of treatment is increasing for some of these patients, but the numbers of survivors is also increasing.
So in this case, we're preventing a return.
Right.
As opposed for prevention from the beginning.
Right. And that's where the bulk of our success has been, and that's considered adjuvant therapy in cancer, and that's not considered prevention. That's actually treatment,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to in the cardiovascular disease world, they would consider that prevention. They'd consider that secondary prevention.
Mm-hmm. But not. But in cancer, this is just called treatment.
Right.
And so in the prevention programs, the community oncology program is primarily in these secondary treatments, or
the community clinical oncology program sort of spans both treatment and prevention and cancer control.
Mm-hmm.
So under the treatment side of things, everything that I've explained has occurred. And so
right.
at the local level, the oncologists have become more sophisticated. The trials, all of the trials, have become somewhat more complicated with more regulatory burden. The care that the local oncologists deliver is more complicated and more multidisciplinary. And that certainly has evolved over time. You're now seeing multidisciplinary clinics in more rural areas than there ever used to be. As the trials have changed, cancer care has also changed in order to reflect where the trial, the results of the trials. Doesn't do that everywhere, but it has. In the same context, the same infrastructure that's been working on the treatment side has also been focused on either the cancer, the symptom management, the quality of life, but also on the true prevention trials.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we had second generation prevention trials with the STAR study and the SELECT studies. And those are now winding down, and there's been, I would say, little support for moving forward with the third set of large cancer prevention trials, primarily right now to have a better understanding of, how to approach large prevention trials. Are there agents ready to move forward with quickly, or do we need to take a pause, so to speak, and get a better understanding of what's happening in terms of targeted therapies and reframe some of our prevention questions?
And who are raising these questions, within DCP or NCI or a larger medical community?
I think within NCI and the larger medical community, as well as within the division. I think the issues are somewhat broader than just the division.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been discussion inside the division and discussion inside NCI, as well as in the broader community, about how to think about agents to bring forward, what information do we need in order to think about how to frame the next, set or the next generation. But consider also that this has happened within the context of larger trials across NIH, too. I mean, other disease prevention areas where interventions that have been considered to be low toxicity have been studied across different diseases. And I think people are now beginning to sort of say, okay, it's important to have these large trials, but maybe we need to think about what goes into them and think about having a strategy for how to bring them forward and what to move into it so that what we bring in has the highest chance of being successful.
Mm-hmm. Is there an old engineering adage that we learn more from our failures and our successes that has ever come to play here or not?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I mean, I think the first thing that we can learn from clinical trials is to expect the unexpected. You know, the Women's Health Initiative was the perfect example. Oh, it's unethical not to give women estrogen. You know, and in the end you find out, oops, it turns out that estrogen's not as good as everybody thinks it is.
Mm-hmm. No, that comes true with a lot of trials, doesn't it?
I mean, it does, yeah. But I mean, that's also part of the strength and the need and the importance of doing the trials.
And in setting them up, let me ask this question: how would you define community for me?
Ah, yes. Well, you know, we are defining it in this program as the local level of oncology care. So essentially, it's local regional. So it's community practices, community. It's where patients actually get the bulk of their oncology care. So the private practices, the community hospitals, there is an interplay with the academic centers where the academic centers are essentially the NIDUSes for the scientific design, et cetera, but not the only. We have a lot of, we have the community docs sitting on the scientific committees to develop the studies so that there is a good interplay between those that are practicing cancer in the community and those that are practicing cancer in an academic setting. And there's more fluidity now than there ever used to be. I mean, it used to be that, 20 years ago, you went into private practice or you joined an academic institution and you were there for the long haul. And now people are moving, 5, 10 years, and there's not just one place they practice their entire lives.
What about, is the nursing community part of this as well?
Oh, absolutely. It really is thought to be at the team level with the physicians and the nurses and potentially other support people there as well.
What about the funding for this? And is this funded both out of the division and at the local level, or the matching funds?
There's no requirement for matching funds, but it is very clear that the majority of CCOPs and minority-based CCOPs bring institutional support to the activity.
Mm-hmm.
And it is felt that institutional support is something that is in everybody's best interest, not just from the monetary or financial perspective, but more from a perspective of really integrating the whole program into that community so that a community hospital may be the grantee organization and may actually be the recipient of the grant, but that grant then provides an umbrella and a means by which that community hospital, in conjunction with its cancer program, then will galvanize to offer research, and potentially there'll be offshoots from that, not just the clinical trials research perspective, but also they'll start to develop programs internal to that community that will feed one another. So it becomes much bigger than just the grant itself.
How do you guarantee that this will continue over the length of time needed to make the statistical results valid?
Well, I mean, part of the reason for funding them through a grant is to make the funding commitment over time, and so that it's not just a year to year, such that if they don't get money that year, well, they have no ability to continue that activity. It's meant to be an ongoing research activity that the institution and the community invests in. And that's part of the reason for having the institutional support. It's an investment. We're going to start this project. It's going to take some time to get started, but it's a long-term commitment. It's not a short-term thing.
And they are, and in that long-term commitment, they have to reciprocate with one of their own, I take it.
Yes.
And when you say when people move, does that mean
physicians.
That PIs will move too? Or
potentially, yes. But the program is such that even if the PI moves, he or she can still be involved in the trials. As long as, you know, it is still possible to move and still maintain your interest and your involvement in the whole program because it's a national program. It's not a regional or a local program.
Okay.
And we've actually had patients be able to move as a result. When Katrina hit, we actually had patients went all over the country. And those patients that were on clinical trials, that knew which trials they were on, were able to continue their clinical trial participation because there were sites across the country.
Doing the same?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How is the community oncology program integrated into the other aspects of the Division of Cancer Protection or Prevention?
Certainly our program is integrated into our program is integrated into the cooperative groups, and to the extent that the rest of the division is involved in the cooperative groups, it's fully integrated. But most of the division is not involved in the cooperative groups, and so we use expertise in the division. We try and share expertise across the programs. It's not always clear that all the other programs in the division are applicable to the community clinical oncology program. Mm-hmm. But in some cases in the drug development side, in the phase 1, phase 2 side, there are some CCOPs that participate in the phase 2 consortium for the development of prevention agents.
And, it strikes me, you know, for so many years, Peter has been the leader of this group. Does he still set the tone for what the Division of Cancer Protection is doing?
Yes.
Could you explain that to an outsider?
From a structural and an organizational perspective, we have meetings on a fairly regular basis. Usually it's a couple times a month with all the branch chiefs, and we talk about issues of scientific importance, issues of administrative, it's a meeting where we do basically the work of the division, and so there's some administrative things that have to be done, but there's also a fair amount of science and an attempt to share across the division what's going on. We've had retreats over the years where we present to one another some of the interesting findings from the studies, some of the interesting research activities in an effort to try and bridge the different programs in the division according to the priorities that are set by the division and set by Peter as well. I mean, so we've had scientific retreats where we'll talk about what things are going on in the different programs, what where the science seems to be moving, and prioritize sort of the areas for all of us to think about, fostering amongst our investigators.
And how is it determined which funding goes where within the division?
It's a combination of where the grants are, so the grants and how well they compete in peer review. That's one piece of it. In fact, that's the biggest piece of it, I think. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the programs and the initiatives, those things that, I guess one of the things in prevention is that so much of the initiatives that have been started are very, very long-term initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
So an effort to try and maintain the commitment to the long-term commitments, as well as identify if there are new opportunities within any of those to tap into. So the PLCO was started, the screening trial for prostate, lung, colorectal, and ovarian cancer was started in the 80s, accrued and was occurring in the 90s, and then early in the 2000s, the whole issue of CT screening came up, and through the PLCO network of investigators, they were able to get up and running rather quickly a randomized controlled CT screening study for lung cancer. And that was really an opportunity built on an existing infrastructure to answer a very pertinent, timely question, and the answer will be coming within the next 18 months, I think.
Indeed, the announcement was about, I guess, 2 weeks ago now, that the cancer rates have been dropping.
Right.
That should have given the division some kind of positive...
Oh, yeah. Well, bubble. You know, some of it happens serendipitously. You know, when you look at the ACS graphs and you can see what's happening with the incidence and the mortality, I mean, it's not like anybody ever implemented a public policy to reduce stomach cancer, you know, and yet stomach cancer has plummeted over the last, you know, century.
Mm-hmm.
And there's speculation, but colon cancer in men has dropped. And, you know, that was probably, and in women has dropped, and that was probably a combination of the availability of NSAIDs and a polypectomy and colonoscopies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yet nobody implemented a national health policy in those regards. So there's a combination of things going on in terms of what actually impacts your cancer incidence rates. And there are certainly some things that we can do. Part of the reason why we think the breast cancer incidences are dropping is because after the Women's Health Initiative, women were tossing out estrogen, and you can actually correlate the drop in the prescription rates for estrogen. So, you know, there are clearly some things linked, and then there are other things that it's not clear. So no, everybody's happy that both the mortality and the incidence are dropping, but not all of it is fully explainable. You know.
This gets me back to the public health issues,
mm-hmm.
especially when you're doing community studies, that as these get announced, it goes into the the realm of public health, an announcement about how important it is to get the colonoscopies,
right.
Which I think in my father's generation probably wasn't, at least I never heard it was very common.
Right.
But certainly in the last 30 years has been. 25 years, maybe.
Yeah. Right. No, okay. So I guess I missed the question. Maybe
well,
I was spacing.
Well, I guess I'm wondering how... does this automatically spill over, especially when you're doing these studies at the local level, and you say working with the local medical community, and that's really the seed of getting this out, as it was, you mentioned, for cardiovascular diseases. So is this not... It seemed to me it's also happening with cancer, with the... advanced diagnoses early on, and then saying that you should be doing this, more mammograms, more, well, even though I guess that one's now come up some, there was some question the last time.
Well, I think the, you know, part of this really also is, yes, we are working with the community, and there are some things that translate very quickly. Most of what translates relatively quickly is on the treatment side, because the investigators at the community level that are involved are, for the most part, oncologists, whether they're medical oncologists, pediatric, GYN, they're all oncologists. And so the treatment pieces seem to translate relatively quickly. At least the investigators within the community adopt the research findings into their practices, so that their practice-wide benefits from the fact that they've been participating in the research and not just the patients that are on the studies. So that's a fairly profound amount of dissemination about the research findings and the improvement in cancer care at the community level. That being said, beyond that, in terms of prevention, is a little harder, because the oncology community isn't as engaged in the delivery of what would be considered prevention modalities. So, I mean, the people that come to the oncologist have cancer. We are beginning to see more family members of at-risk women come to the oncologist for a discussion about risk, because the internists at this point in time are not as adept in discussing the risk for cancer as the oncologists are. And for the most part, this is now, right at this point in time, pretty much limited to what we know about hereditary cancer. So BRCA1 and 2, what we are seeing is breast oncologists delivering some counseling recommendations to family members of BRCA1 and 2 mutation carriers. We're not necessarily seeing that in non-oncology practices. So it's a little harder to, we also are not necessarily seeing discussion about at-risk women for BRCA1 and 2 at the family practice, the internist level. We're seeing much more of that occurring at the level of the oncologist. So it's a little harder to bring the prevention constructs out of oncology and back into internal medicine.
Why do you think that's the case?
I think it's because all of the research that is happening in risk is happening in oncology. And at the practical level, what happens in terms of the identification of these at-risk people is coming through family members.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have the family come to the oncologist because one member has cancer. They do a family history and they start counseling in the context of they take care of the patient, but they also start counseling the rest of the individuals as to what, because then that becomes the discussion of, well, what is my risk? And, the quintessential scenario is the woman with breast cancer who's a BRCA1 or 2 mutation carrier who comes with her sister and her daughter, and you talk to the patient, but you also end up counseling the sister and daughter about what they should be doing as well. And it's not something that is a discussion that they're having with their internist.
I understand. Which of the programs would you highlight as as you think being most successful out of the community programs since you've been running them?
You mean in terms of the across the country, the different programs?
Yeah.
We have several. There's one in Wichita. There in Wichita, Kansas. There's one in Delaware. There's one in the South that encompasses multiple states. But those are the ones that are high accruers, high data, data quality. Those are the big guns successes. I would also say we have small successes, because we do have communities that have steadily been involved in cancer research for two decades, that do a wonderful, consistent, high-quality job in smaller communities as well, in Iowa, in parts of rural Illinois, parts of South Dakota, you know, the Midwest and the South have been tremendously good for smaller communities. I mean, this program is wonderful for smaller communities because it galvanizes the whole community around, you know, the idea of contributing and helping out for cancer and cancer research.
And do they come to you, for example, there was a, I've forgotten the name, is it Anniston in Alabama, where they had all the chemical plants and there was high incidence of cancer? Would a place like that come in as a community? Or is that too, is that...
That's too,
an anomaly and not
right.
What you'd want to take.
Right.
The anomaly, then.
It's more the anomaly,
yeah,
yes.
You'd rather do something than...
Well, we do best by working through the oncologists, mm-hmm, as opposed to working directly with the community. It's the community oncologist that we form the relationship with, and the community oncologists work within their community to develop the program.
And this is a group that has been growing, or are you now, over the past 20 years?
It has grown over the past 20 years. It's been really hard the last, I'd say, 6 years with the budget kind of, you know, being fixed for multiple years now. It's been a little hard. It's been much harder to grow the program. We've done well by sort of consolidating, is not the right word. We've done better by identifying which are the success, you know, which programs are keeping their infrastructure in place, which ones have a weak infrastructure and maybe need to rethink the program. So we have new CCOPs and we have lost old CCOPs. We haven't had a huge influx to be able to support significant further growth. But I would say at the same token, it's not just the dollars that NIH provides, it's also the dollars at the local level. And we're hearing much more these days about difficulties at the local level because of reduced reimbursements for medical care. And I'm very concerned that the financial situation in the country, the economic situation in the country, is going to have a bigger impact on the program in general than potentially the funding that NIH can or cannot provide.
Has there been any tradition of outside funding by private groups? Excuse me.
Bless you.
Thank you.
Not outside funding to NIH or NCI to distribute.
No, into the communities, I mean. That would tie into the...
Well, yes, they are. There are. I mean, depending on the community, there is fundraising done at the local level. As I said, I mean, what happens is the grant provides a platform for a program. That program involves fundraising at the local level to help support those things that are not covered in the NIH grant.
And would they go to other medical funding foundations like...
Well,
Johnson,
they already do. So some of the CCOPs get an Avon grant. They can't go to Hughes because Hughes is science-based. You know, where they do the best is go to those. There are foundations that provide the support for the research to happen.
Uh-huh.
So the Komen Foundation, Avon, other things like that, where they're raising money and they provide additional money. Whereas Howard Hughes is basically, you know, funding specific investigators to do specific science. That's not applicable to the community.
Okay. And that would be the same as the Johnson Foundation or anything like that. What have I missed? That is important to get in here.
Well, I mean, I think we've been fortunate in oncology that we have had so many oncologists participate in the program that we really do see a translation of the research results into practice across the country. I think cancer care is improved because so many physicians are involved. And by being involved, they take ownership in the research themselves, and by taking ownership, then, you know, want to be at, you know, the forefront of providing the best quality care. And I think honestly, the physicians engaged and involved in this program believe that, and that is their prime motivation. They want to give their patients the best possible care. They feel that participating in science keeps them in the leading edge, and they can do that as a result of offering the studies and then offering the regimens once they're successfully reviewed to their patients.
Mm-hmm.
That's it in a nutshell.
And the future for the Division of Cancer Protection?
The future for the Division of Cancer Prevention, I think it can be very bright as we get a better understanding of genomics and a better understanding of carcinogenesis, and possibly tailor our prevention strategies a little bit more to the at-risk population. I think, you know, we're going to, over the next 10 years, we're going to identify better profiles for risk. And that has to happen, that almost has to happen first as we move into where we want to go in prevention.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I appreciate it. And if I just may also take the opportunity to ask if I need more information to be able to call you back.
Absolutely. Call me back, email me.
Okay.
You know, especially if you say, well, I don't understand what you said here. I'm happy to clarify.
Well, that may occur. But thank you very much, and best for the holidays.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.